everybody. So I think we have like 17 or 18 CCL volunteers joining us just on the teleconference. And Dan, I just wanted to make sure you got a feel of the sort of individuals who are joining us on the line and who are in this room. We've got some climate citizens here who are working very, very hard to change the politics of clean energy and get a federal bill through the Congress. So the people on this line are not just gonna, do a click through on their Facebook page, and they're not just gonna sit around their friends and gripe about this or that, but they're gonna start putting together meetings with their members of Congress, with their local representatives, and really trying to stitch together the network and the political will we need to move Congress in the right direction. And this room right now has about 60 folks in it. I don't know if you can see it, but it's a pretty amazing collection of talent and leadership. And for the other CCL volunteers who are on this call, what we're doing here, this is an advanced policy boot camp, and we are running a simulated negotiation, a climate negotiation. There's an international track, and there is a domestic track. And our effort here is to get into some of the very nitty-gritty details of carbon pricing. And I invited Professor Kamen here to talk to us about his insider's perspective on the happenings with the Paris Agreement. And so with that, Dan, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your wonderful effort, both as a professor and a teacher, and as a negotiator. So thank you. You're up.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to really thank everyone for being on. I mean, the kind of work that you all do is not only vital in general, but it's, of course, incredibly vital now as the U.S. has taken a huge step, I don't even want to say backwards, but out of the intelligent stream of thought. And so getting members of Congress and members of the House and Senate back on track is really critical. And so what I'd like to do is to use the next half hour to do three steps in the process, but I'm hoping that people will use the dialogue box and will ask questions or post comments or disagreements, and we will stop directly as we go to use them as points of departure. And so what I'm going to try to do is three things. The first will be to describe a little bit about the situation here in California and the kind of unique spot that my laboratory and my team are in. Then do a little bit of general stuff that I know that you know about the Paris Agreement, but as someone who has been to 13 straight COPs, there's some interesting elements of the story. And then I want to sort of make it as broad a conversation as we all can about the ways to move ahead meaningful climate legislation, despite what Mr. Trump has done. And I say that as someone who writes, for example, for Scientific American. If you just go online right now and look up why the Democrats and Republicans are both right on climate, you'll see one of my more recent pieces about why I actually think, not only from an environmental perspective, but in terms of what would be good for the U.S. job-wise, I'm actually arguing that the ideal would actually be to have both President Obama, the Democrats' Clean Power Plan, layered with the so-called conservative solution, which is the George Shultz, James Baker carbon tax and dividend version, something I've worked on quite a bit, and I'll explain why in the next slides. So my day job, if you will, is to direct this program, the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory, here at UC Berkeley. It has about 25 graduate students, undergraduates, and postdocs. And we work on everything from carbon footprinting tools up to household and mini-grid level systems in rural North America, in Nicaragua, in Indonesia and Malaysia and Borneo and East Africa. And we work on regional power systems from the East African power pool to the Mexican power system to the Chinese power system to the North American power system, where we build what electrical engineers called capacity expansion models to figure out what would it take to be on that 2-degree or 1.5-degree pathway. That's my day job. My regular advising role for the California state industry, California state institutions, is to work with our governor, and I've worked with the last three governors quite in detail, the California Energy Commission, the Public Utilities Commission, and the Air Resources Board that implements and oversees both California's current climate law, Assembly Bill 32, that goes to 2020, and then the new one, Senate Bill 32, that goes to 2020. I know that you guys all know about those in some detail, but it's worth putting them in the context of this national story. The last item at the bottom of this front slide, you'll notice, is a bit of a interesting creature. I currently serve as science envoy for the U.S. State Department and for the Secretary of State. And while I was appointed by Secretary Kerry with a focus on energy and climate in Africa and the Middle East, I am continuing under Secretary Tillerson with a focus on energy in Africa and the Middle East. And so there are some interesting opportunities to engage and hopefully to support what you all will be doing in the CCL in terms of the conversations that I can have with Secretary Tillerson and others in the administration, even though they are certainly not showing the most welcoming face at the moment. And so I think that hopefully frames a little bit who and what we are. And it sets up just the fact that we are designed to be a resource for you. The website you see here, mylaboratoryrail.berkeley.edu, is a very complete set of research papers, transcripts, videos, feature-length movies and documentaries we've released, including a recent NOVA show on energy storage, a movie we just released in regular theaters called Time to Choose. And the Twitter feed at the bottom, even though it's at Dan Kamen, is not my vacation pictures. It's designed to be one or two at most tweets a day about the work we're doing in my laboratory in California and with the State Department. So I urge you all to follow that if you want to get updates without being overloaded by materials from what we're working on. This just kind of shows you my laboratory. If I were to just go across this group, it really highlights the international nature. The woman in my bottom left is a member of the Navajo tribe. Next to her is a gentleman from Chile. On my right is someone from Peru, and then from Honduras, from on this back row, from Canada, from Trinidad, France, India, Nigeria, Costa Rica, Mexico, and down here is someone from that developing country of the District of Columbia. And so we have a range of types of people working on these problems. And again, it's a fairly large group in terms of working on many aspects of clean power systems. We've also had some nice interactions at the international level. I've been working inside the IPCC as a so-called coordinating lead author since the late 90s. And of course, we co-shared the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 with Vice President Al Gore. And since there are several thousand of us, I guess that makes us micro-Gores or some other odd unit of clean energy research and analysis. Before we talk about the Paris Climate Accord, I really want to stress the degree to which I would argue that while Kyoto was a failure for a variety of reasons, both in terms of its scope, its vision, and its structure, the Paris Climate Accord was a success directly due to something that U.S. President Obama and Premier Xi did at the APEC Summit of 2014, and that was to be very unconventional. I'm a physicist, not a political scientist, but the deal that these two gentlemen struck, the so-called G2 of energy and climate, because of course the United States and China together are about 40% of global energy consumption and 40% of greenhouse gas emissions, was to set up an agreement that was everyone do what they can do. President Obama said via the Clean Power Plan that his goal was to cut emissions for the United States by a third by 2025, with each state committed to cutting a third from its own baseline. So not competing West Virginia against California, but competing everyone against their initial starting position. And that led to some curious features. Kentucky, for example, home of Senator Mitch McConnell, is a state that, even though it's almost entirely coal-powered in terms of electricity, was already set to meet the Clean Power Plan goals before it began because of its own transition based on economic grounds to natural gas. California, New York, Wisconsin, Florida had various aggressive plans on their own, but all of which were competing against their own starting point, not trying to make it a competition between actors. Premier Xi committed to peaking China's emissions in the year 2030 at an unspecified level, which sounded far too vague and asymmetric with the United States. But in fact, if we look at the recent data, China may be on a path to peak its emissions a decade early. And of course, with China's announcement earlier this year that it was ramping up to invest $360 billion in clean energy and perhaps another $100 billion in building first an Asian regional grid and then potentially pushing towards a global super grid, with Mr. Trump's decision to pull at least the federal government back out of the Paris process, that essentially is a $1 trillion gift in jobs and revenue to China, for which congressmen and women, senators on both sides of the aisle, can really find jobs-based, employment-based, infrastructure-based opportunities to get the U.S. back in the equation despite Mr. Trump's misstep. This graph, I hope, is the one that's familiar to everyone, and it really summarizes what went on. In 2014, as I mentioned, at the APEC summit, the U.S. and China committed to their paths. And when you add up what every country committed to in their own national INDCs or individual national commitments, that amounts to the pink area at the top. Some countries emphasize renewable energy, Costa Rica and Kenya. Some countries emphasize conservation of ocean resources, Mauritius. Some countries emphasized forest conservation, Democratic Republic of Congo. Each of those commitments were translated into our best estimate for the carbon impacts, and that led to this pink area, shaving a degree off the top. Now, that doesn't get us to 2 degrees or the 1.5 degree high ambition coalition, but it highlights a bring what you can strategy. Of course, none of it's happened yet, so holding ourselves to the fire, developing science-based metrics, to being fiercely loyal to the truth, perhaps, if we use Mr. Comey's words of today, are all elements of a strategy that we need to verify and implement through the Paris Accords, with or without the U.S. as a nation part of the story. But it also highlights this big gap of things we need to do. The Paris Accord was agreed to December 2015, but by Earth Day 2016, we already had it ratified, something that's never happened before in international treaty history. And that's largely because this treaty celebrated countries' own best efforts to get to the Paris total. It didn't say everyone must do the same thing. It celebrated diversity. The other element was that things were so aggressive in the Paris process that within 6 months afterwards, the so-called Kigali Accord had been signed, our former Secretary of State's Kerry's last major act, and that shaves another half degree off this through a series of HCFC and CFC measures. And this just speaks to the degree to which if you give countries, universities, businesses, individuals a chance to innovate and to do their best, which is what the Paris Accords were all about, we see that a great deal is possible. I won't get into the details of the different pathways and the models, except to note that those pathways that meet not only the 2 degree, the RCP5 scenarios, but the deeper cuts, the RCP4.5 or the RCP2.6 scenarios that you can see on the left, they start to require something that goes beyond clean energy. You'll notice a significant number of those pathways actually call for us to have carbon negative emissions, and indeed a number of very, very thoughtful climate and energy researchers believe that the 2 degree pathway is no longer possible unless we find dramatic ways to go carbon negative, which could be reinvesting in forests, rebuilding smart agriculture, and a variety of features before we even get to the scarier words, about geoengineering, and I'm not going to get into that today just based on time. The Clean Power Plan, of course, which Mr. Trump is doing his best to walk away from, highlights how diverse our states are in their baselines, but it also highlights how states that are very coal-dominated today can get a great deal of the way to their clean energy plans by investing in clean and non-leaky natural gas. States that are a mix of natural gas and some renewables need to double down on solar and wind and other technologies, but it is a recipe for diversity where in our analysis in my lab at Berkeley and many others, we find multiple pathways to get to low carbon economies, essentially all of which are than the status quo. In fact, if we go back to the state that really started it, this is a PowerPoint slide done way before PowerPoint. This is back in the 1970s when Enrico Fermi, the father of the atomic bombs, last graduate student, Dr. Arthur Rosenfeld, produced a graph of California's future, famous today, that showed the business as usual growth rate and then the so-called hard path of investing in lots of nuclear, lots of fossil, and lots of hydro to meet a growing energy demand. What Professor Rosenfeld, he became a Berkeley professor. He was then awarded the National Medal of Science by President Obama. He's called the father of energy efficiency. Highlighted was if we're energy efficient, we shave off this entire wedge of energy use, making our job easier, making energy cost less, and it allows us to think about a more diverse range of solutions. This was considered heretical in the 1960s and 70s, but yet, when we look at what actually happened, this is electricity use per person in the United States in red, California in blue. We see they were roughly the same up until the OPEC oil crisis. And then the investments in industrial, commercial, and residential energy efficiency have meant that California, whose economy has grown faster than the national economy in every single five-year block since the 70s, and vastly outperformed the national economy in the last decade, has seen electricity use per person remaining flat. And so while California has one of the higher costs of electricity, nowhere near the highest, but in the highest third, California's electricity bills are some of the lowest, and a wise investment in natural gas and then renewables has allowed us to chart out a path much more like Europe and very different than the rest of the country. In fact, California's goal for 2010 was to be 20% powered by renewables. We missed our target and threw a party and met it 3 years later. By 2020, our goal is 33% renewables. We are ahead of schedule. And California announced a 2030 goal, now signed into law, that we be 50% renewables by 2030. And renewables in California do not include nuclear and do not include large hydro. And just last week, the California legislature voted by a 2-to-1 majority to adopt a 2045 target of 100% renewables. We would not do that as the world's fifth largest economy if we couldn't do that cost effectively. That stands in complete a contrast to what we're hearing out of Washington. And it's the kind of example at the industrial scale that should change the story. In fact, earlier this week, Washington State, New York, and California signed the U.S. Climate Pact, of which now I believe 10 or 11 states have joined in. And that accounts for about 43% of the U.S. national GDP already signed on, highlighting this under two pathway with, again, California's and others really being more aggressive still. And so that is a clear example of the yes, we can strategy. I won't go into the details of it, but what I've highlighted here is basically what I've showed you. This is California's greenhouse gas emissions. In about 2007, we were about 25% above our 1990 or IPCC baseline. We will be under that in 2020. Our 2030 goal is to cut it by a third, 2040 by another third, 2050 by a third, to get down to 2 degrees or less. If we look at the overall mix of energy in the system, we have a situation where California is now home to some of the largest solar at the level of large-scale PV projects, at the level of large-scale solar projects that are crystalline, that are thin film, solar thermal. We have the view of the biggest solar thermal one from space. We have some of the oldest solar thermal projects as well. We have a wide range of technologies. This is the world's largest geothermal facility. And overall, what we're seeing here is an opportunity to invest at the utility scale, largest flow battery system in the country. It's a wide range of technologies, all of which meet these goals. Here is the country's largest wind farm. It is about to be eclipsed by larger wind farms in Morocco and in Turkey, but it again highlights the ability to get these aggressive targets done. And again, California's done these while growing the economy at a rate faster than what we're seeing at the national level. And again, it just speaks to the degree to which these paths are possible and they make economic sense. And again, in a skeptical federal administration, that level of looking at what you actually can do is a critical part of the story. Of course, one of the examples that we're remarkably proud of and surprised at is the degree to which California has seen auto manufacturing come back into the state in Tesla, which is now opening a new battery factory, not only in Nevada, but in New York State and elsewhere. So it is a very different picture of what matters economically than we see in many of the federal conversations. California has continued this aggressive push on energy efficiency, something that we see in a number of European countries, in Korea, in Japan, and California has, as an example, a requirement that all new homes built after 2020 be net zero energy. By emphasizing energy efficiency and either rooftop solar or homes that can have a market share of solar that's off-site, for example, on the roof of a big box store nearby. So there's lots of ways to be creative about how to put together these kinds of economies. All of these features are critical in thinking through carbon pricing, federal legislation, opportunities to invest in state or municipal PACE or property assessed clean energy programs, and to find places to put revenues from carbon prices, carbon taxes, cap and trade programs that really do build on the industrial capacity of the country and return jobs to the cities, states, and regions that aggressively promote it. I mentioned before that our laboratory is also directly involved in modeling other power systems, and I show you a map here of the parts of the world that my laboratory, as one example, builds exceedingly detailed power systems models. Model of North America, model of Mexico, Nicaragua, China, Kenya, Chile. We're finishing up some others in Southeast Europe and Kosovo. And all of these are examples of partnerships that we have with governments to work on the energy strategies they want, no matter what Mr. Trump says about what he thinks the U.S. wants, and to put those together so that this is really a coalition of the willing, dedicated to the facts about energy and job creation, but also highlighting the ability for us to invest in solutions that we can share around the planet so that the Paris Accord goes forward no matter what the U.S. at the federal level does, because in fact, the action is at lower levels than that. It's at the states, it's at the provinces and cantons around the world. The details of the modeling efforts that we did are on that website I showed you. You can see the website right at the top here where all the models, all the data is available. But I want to highlight one little story here, and that is when we look, for example, at North America going from 2020 at the top to 2050 at the bottom, what I'm showing you here is the power mix in a whole bunch of different scenarios. The reference scenario at left, SunShot, which is the federal effort to make solar inexpensive. It's already met those goals. What if we have low-cost batteries? What if we have nuclear and carbon capture? A whole range of scenarios. All of these pathways get to the 2-degree goal, and I'm going to ignore this one here where we're not energy efficient. It gets there, but it's more expensive, and why would we want to do that? But all of these get there, and what that means is that the real argument about climate legislation is not about waiting for a given technology solar, batteries, nuclear, whatever your favorite might be, to save us. All of these pathways are based on realistic views of technologies we have today. The real challenge is leadership. With so many technical options to get us there, the critical part of the story is who steps forward, captures those jobs, and finds ways to return that to citizens, red states, blue states, rich and poor, in the ways that we're seeing in places like California, where I obviously have highlighted that I work, but also where I just came back from last week at the behest of the Secretary of State, Morocco, a country with a higher green energy target than any U.S. state, 52% by 2030. They're on pace to get there, and they are seeing higher job growth in a country about the size of California, with about the population of California, with about the rainfall and the area of California. And they are seeing their ability to get there starting from a fairly low technical base to be a challenge that has actually grown the economy and has made Morocco a global leader in this conversation, as I highlight in the slide here. All you really need to know for you non-French speakers is their target is 52% clean energy by 2030, 10 gigawatts, that's 10,100 megawatts. So 10.1 gigawatts of power, and they are on target to get there. In terms of the nitty-gritty details, I'm just going to close with a couple notes about where we are. This is a famous slide produced by the U.S. National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and it shows the increase in efficiency of a whole range of solar technologies. It's probably one of the more complicated plots you can look at, but each of these lines is the story of innovation and the story of deployment. The slope of the line, if you will, shows efficiency change per year. But it could also be looked at in terms of dollars invested in research, something that Mr. Trump is threatening to cut from our EPA, DOE, and other budgets, something which would cost U.S. jobs massively in the face of China and others scaling up their investment in this area. And of course, the most famous curve is probably this one, which is the cost of solar power, not plotted against time. This is plotted in log units or decadal units against total deployment. This is called a learning curve. What it shows is the slope of this line, where you see time is just a date stamp along the way, shows solar is now at or below the cost of fossil alternatives. And it is a technology that we're installing at large utility scale, we're installing at household scale, we're installing it at small off-grid and mini-grid scale, everything from small communities in the Midwest to communities in Alaska, to Native American and First Peoples in Canada, to mini grids I install in Kenya, in Malaysia, in Laos and Myanmar. It is a technology that has the robustness to scale. And this sort of learning curve is exactly what we're seeing today now for storage, for wind, for flow batteries, for a whole variety of technologies. And this is why, quite frankly, Mr. Trump is just plain wrong. Politics won't save coal. Politics, in the end, won't save gas. What ultimately will save us is investing in good job-creating technologies that allow us to meet not only environmental goals, but economic targets of job creation that can't be outsourced, that create locally vibrant economies. And that, sadly, is what Mr. Trump is turning his back on, by not grabbing the Paris bull by the horns and running with it. So I'll just close with one final picture, and that is that one of the biggest opportunities to invest in sustainability around the planet, to cut the cost of U.S. military, is something that Secretary of Defense Mattis has said, and the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff have said, and that is every cut to our budget for innovation and overseas partnerships is an extra dollar that we have to spend on putting U.S. soldiers in harm's way. And so no amount of politics removes the fact that the more we can make sustainable energy access, not only for U.S. citizens, but also people around the planet, a right and an expected feature from their government, that feeds exactly into the sort of democratic century that U.S., at least until the current person took office, is what we were highlighting. So I'm going to stop there. I hope that gives us a lot of range for discussion, but also some opportunities to think about how these elements can be put into concrete and detailed bills, be they around carbon pricing, domestic and overseas engagement. Thank you very much for the time, and I look forward to us chatting for as long as you want to go on.
Okay, good. Can you hear me, Dan?
Very well, yep.
All right, good. All right. Could you hear the applause too?
I did. I appreciate that. I think it was hopefully more for how exciting the story is than for a speaker, but I thank you.
You're a rock star. Do you have some chat questions that came to you digitally that you want to take care of?
Yes, I see several right here.
Okay.
Sorry, actually, I only see one right here. Let me start by answering that one. Okay. When California has so much renewable energy, how do California's power utilities deal with peak power demand when the sun isn't shining and when the wind isn't blowing? Isn't it inefficient to suddenly ramp up natural gas or diesel power generation to meet demand? So, great question. First of all, California does not permit diesel use. California has zeroed out coal use. California uses natural gas today, and in fact, ramping up natural gas in the near term is highly efficient. We are able to do so without the so-called burst of emissions that we used to get in the old days from load following or ramping natural gas plants. But we're only using natural gas now as a bridge. And by that, I mean that our long-term goal, well before 2050, is that natural gas also will play no long-term role in California. And that's not because renewables are so wonderfully plentiful here. In fact, the wind resource in the middle of the country, the red states, is far better than our wind resource and comparable to our solar resource. So what California's done is to utilize the low natural gas prices today to give us essentially a buffer and a battery while we ramp up commercial storage. So if I backtrack in the slides to one I skipped here, this shows the price history for storage, which is the exact counterpart to this price history, sorry, I went the wrong way, to this price history here for solar. Storage right now is evolving exactly the way storage has done. And so as of today, California, like Germany, has a requirement for storage. In California, we require storage that's batteries, flywheels, and other new storage technology shown on this slide here to be able to provide 2% of our peak demand by 2020. And we're about to increase that to probably 5 or 7% by 2025 or 2027, depending where the legislature and our state commissions push. That will give us a buffer to store energy. And so what this question is referring to is something also called the so-called duck curve, meaning that the demand for power is often highest late afternoon when industry and business are still on and people come home and turn things on. But what actually happens is that because of so much solar with storage, either in Powerwall batteries from Tesla or in the battery of your electric vehicle or in some of the facilities I showed before, like the Flow battery in California, we can bank some of that excess clean energy during the day or wind energy at night and utilize it during the next 24, 48, 72 hours to balance this out. And so we see gas as our short-term bridge, but by the late 2030s or early 2040s, we absolutely see storage and clean energy driving the entire energy system.
Okay, thanks, Dan. I got a question here. I'm gonna generalize it a little bit.
Okay.
We get a lot of questions from our members of Congress about nuclear as a low carbon or no carbon energy source. This particular question is about the subsidies for nuclear.
Right.
One thing that one of our faculty for tomorrow are two individuals who worked on the Illinois Clean Jobs Bill, and that has a zero energy credit in it, which is a subsidy. So I'm sure we'll get into depth into it at that point.
But good.
Okay. The actual technology, what do you think?
So I'm a professor of nuclear engineering. It was on that first slide. And nuclear faces a huge number of challenges. If it can meet those challenges honestly, it has a huge role to play. And I would argue that the low carbon credits should be extended to nuclear. The problem is that nuclear has now had 50 years of a far higher level of subsidy than renewables have had, and has not made the transition to economic profitability. Even leaving out the risk of nuclear, which is a big if, nuclear faces a basic economic challenge. It is very expensive. It takes a very long time to come online, and nuclear's past doesn't show the learning curve I showed before. It shows a forgetting curve, a rise in costs over time. Now, if I'm a nuclear proponent, if I'm Bill Gates, if I'm Warren Buffett, if I'm a number of others, I'll look at the data and say, yes, that's nuclear's past before the private sector got involved. And that's true. Nuclear today has more investment dollars in the private sector than by the federal government, and that's never happened before. Even if the best nuclear story transpires, the most optimistic view of Mr. Gates and many others, nuclear faces a massive challenge. And again, I would love nuclear to work, whether it's pebble bed, traveling wave reactors, molten salt, small modular reactors. There's lots of technologies that are interesting from a physics perspective. But we have 425 nuclear reactors in the world today. Every single one of them must be retired by the year 2040. The number of nuclear reactors that are being built or are under consideration to be built today by 2030 is 60. Mm. 30 in China, 30 elsewhere. For the world to have an order of magnitude expansion beyond that, so we were talking about, say, 600 big reactors, is simply not in the cards unless the breakthroughs happen at the rate they're happening for cell phones and other technologies. If you're a nuclear optimist, you can argue for that. If you're a nuclear pessimist, you can say, forget it, not going to happen. And that's way before we talk about the massive water demands, the risks, the other features of nuclear. So it has a possible role. I would dearly love it. In fact, as a physicist, my informal prediction is that by 2070, the world will be half to two-thirds solar, wind, geothermal, ocean energy, and the rest will be nuclear. A huge expansion from today, but nuclear's got a lot to do to get there. Let me jump in this question that came up is here.
Okay.
It says, how can we deploy renewables without fixing the grid? Can we have a policy that pays farmers to sequester carbon? Is a symmetrical carbon royalty for negative emissions? So the first part, we cannot meet any of our energy goals, not just clean energy, but energy reliability, without investing in the grid. In fact, a smart grid. That's a place where Mr. Trump's trillion-dollar infrastructure bill could be massively useful. And I would argue that's exactly where we should start the investments in this area. It's a perfect place to go to make things happen. Because renewables have high upfront cost and no operating costs or very little operating costs, investing in the grid over time, and I don't just mean big transmission lines and high voltage lines, I also mean the distribution system, allows us to build an eBay, if you will, where everyone is a buyer and seller and utilities are actually profitable. That's an opportunity under this system. But we have to invest to get there, there's no question. We could pay farmers. Currently, farmers that have wind turbines generally make more money from their wind turbine than their crop, unless they're growing a certain crop in Colorado or California that we'll leave aside. And this idea about investing in carbon sequestration, we actually could. We could pay farmers to grow crops that suck up carbon. We would also want insurance because we don't want that carbon to leak out of the ground as it's doing from underground storage in Ontario and North Dakota. But there's lots of ways to absolutely find ways to incentivize private citizens and recognize many of those private citizens would be in red states. they would profit handsomely, particularly because the U.S. best wind resource is almost all red states, and the fabulous and unexploited solar resource in the Texases, the Alabamas, the Georgias, Louisiana is just a fabulous resource, wildly underexploited.
Dan, I got two questions about finance. So maybe if you don't associate with bankers, you won't know the answer. But when financial institutions make investment calls, are they looking at the learning curves, the technology learning curves that you showed? And basically, is private finance enough? Or do you need something like climate bonds, other types of public financing?
That's a great question. So I spend a huge amount of time with bankers. I try to be selective on which ones they are. People like Richard Kaufman, head of the New York State Green Bank. People like Peter Liu that runs the Green Bank in California. Michael Liebreich at Bloomberg New Energy Finance. A whole variety of bankers. Mike Eckhart at Citigroup. At Citibank. People who recognize these learning curves. Most bankers, sadly, do not. And more importantly, we don't even think the climate problem is that expensive. It would actually be a great jobs bill. It would be FDR number two if we invested in this area. The U.S. has more than enough money that's available looking for opportunities. But until there's a carbon price, it's very difficult to get very traditional institutions to start internalizing these features. In fact, I would argue that the social cost of carbon, estimated to be $30 to $40 would be our goal, but I would simply take a flat minimum, a $5 per ton price of carbon to get us rolling and see how much money that liberates. And that is really an opportunity to spread the wealth away from the Californians and New Yorks that already have their own mechanisms to get things done to the other states. And so we do need financing, but there's no shortage of capital that if our bottom line reflected these values, if it even reflected reliable energy and jobs, forgetting climate, we would already have a metric that would push money into the space. The last thing I'd mention is that we in Berkeley and then 20 states followed quickly, adopted a measure that we created here called PACE, Property Assessed Clean Energy. It's basically allowing you to take out a mortgage so that you can invest in efficiency and renewables, not just renewables, do efficiency first. PACE exists in 20 states. It is an underutilized mechanism to make the upfront cost of clean energy go away. And it's the kind of thing that we can push state by state or even have a federal PACE bank. There's a wonderful resource called PACE Now, PACENOW.org. It's based out of New York City, and it highlights the opportunities to invest in this area.
Okay, a couple more. Two questions that are generally along the theme of an alleged mild adverse hostility amongst the clean energy industry to supporting carbon pricing, and at the same another question about a detected hostility amongst the big electrical utilities to carbon pricing. So. Yep. Are those two areas where there's adverse sentiment, and how do you overcome that? Maybe those are wrong observations.
No, I think there's kind of adverse reactions to all kinds of things. I am totally baffled by why some environmental groups don't want carbon pricing. It essentially is just saying let's pay for the damage that industry does. We have tariffs on hunting. We have tariffs on pollution. And so it doesn't make sense to me that we wouldn't do that this year too, especially because you can return the revenues to citizens. I'm a huge fan of the so-called conservative approach to climate change, which is to have a carbon price and to rebate some or most of the money back to Americans so that benefits the poor Americans first, and hold some of it to invest, to find ways to invest in utilities, to incentivize banks. There's lots of things you can do. Why there is resistance, I really just think it's lack of experience with anything new. It doesn't make sense. In fact, it is a job producing opportunity. And So I think that's one of the areas where education about how carbon prices have worked in places like British Columbia and California that have done it right is an example to contrast to where it's been done wrong, which is in New England and in Europe, where RGGI and the EPS have not been successful models because they were too lax in giving away permits. So there was no strong impact on the bottom line.
Okay, so we have at least another 10 minutes for an hour. Let's see.
I've got one here at the bottom of the page. It says, okay. We'll have 1,000 CCL volunteers on the Hill on Tuesday. Is there an aspect of your research that could help us to convey the benefits of carbon fee and dividend to our members on Congress? I think absolutely. So that website I showed with the switch model is a very detailed website where we highlight the benefits of having a carbon price that can be dividended back. Because we find that the more you invest in clean energy, the more jobs you create those jobs in state. So the more aggressive a state target is, the more of a benefit you get out of the story. And we also know that one of the most interesting ways to motivate individuals is to invest in competitive measures where everyone benefits. And so I'm going to do something a bit risky. I'm going to try to step out of the presentation if I can. Pull up a website. This may or may not work properly. Let's see if it does. But one thing that we created was I'm going to try to pull this up. Let's see if this is successful. We created for Governor Schwarzenegger a carbon footprint calculator, which is now used by a number of states, and it is used by the governments of Germany and Sweden and others. And this is an example, but I should spell it right. So here is just one example of a calculator, Cool Climate, Berkeley EDU, where you can go in and you can do a carbon audit for yourself and you can see how much you save. So these tools are the various carbon footprint calculators. And if we go down, there are some interactive maps that will allow you to look at the carbon footprint in your zip code. You can compare it to the carbon footprint that you just did for yourself with using the various tools. This might be too slow to load up. Let me try it right here. But you can put in your zip code. It'll show you some very pretty maps. It's going to take a minute or two to load up just because I wasn't planning on doing it here. There's apps that you can do. In fact, here's the federal map. You can go zip code by zip code. I'll just jump into some zip codes. And if you look closely at the cities, you will notice they look like reverse pimples. The carbon footprint is almost always lower in an urban area because for the same level of income, you typically have a smaller home, use less energy required to deliver your Amazon purchases to you, your Uber Eats, your whatever else you're doing. But we also have areas where this is the overall map, but you can go in and look, for example, at the footprint for your transportation budget, your food budget, goods and services. And this provides ways to understand the energy choices and how we make them and what they mean. And so I would urge you to go to this, show it to your representative, put up their hometown, encourage them to put the numbers in. And I won't be able to do it right here, but if you put in your data on your energy use, one car, two cars, 10 cars, are you a vegetarian, vegan, vampire, whatever you might be, you will find it will then list out for you the things you haven't done. Roof insulation, buying a more efficient car, being a vegetarian, whatever it might be, the next activities and how much not only carbon you'll save, but in general, how much money you'll save over 1 year and 10 years by investing in these different areas.
Okay, I got one more. There's a couple here, but one I really like. California and Morocco have similar renewable energy goals. Are those transportation, heating, or only electricity?
So California and Morocco have almost identical goals for electricity. They want 52% renewables by 2030. We want 50% renewables by 2030, but we don't include large hydro and nuclear. And California has a very aggressive clean vehicle standard. Morocco doesn't have any vehicle standard yet. And just to put it in, California has a standard to have 1 million solar rooftops by 2020. When that was passed 4 years ago, that was seen as an impossible goal. California now has around 600,000 solar rooftops. We will almost certainly make our 2020 goal. It no longer looks aggressive. California also has a goal of 1 million electric vehicles by 2020. We currently have 300,000 on the road today. That vehicle, that standard was ridiculed initially and said it was impossible. And while we might not get all the way to 1 million EVs out of a fleet of 17 million vehicles, it is a goal that does not look impossible. And it's the kind of goal that actually we just sat down with the Minister of Energy and Transportation in not only Morocco, but also in Portugal. We had meetings in Norway. Norway is now committed to having Oslo to be a 100% electric vehicle city by 2030. They already have the most EVs per capita in the world. And they have longer term goals of 2040 to be a vehicle free city, private vehicle free city. So a range of aggressive goals.
Wow. Should we entertain one more question, you think?
Sounds good to me.
Okay. This, I take this as a question about the relative priority for grid, adapting the grid with respect to a high voltage DC grid for wind versus storage, relative priority on those.
So that's a really interesting, complicated question. We use that model switch I mentioned. It's an open source model. Anyone here can use the results. We have detailed results state by state. But for me, it's not an either or. Where we have large wind farms, like the one in Kern County I showed you, or the ones in Western China, or the ones in Eastern Turkey, they would likely benefit by having high voltage DC lines running from them to the big demand centers. But at the same time, high voltage DC lines don't allow you to serve the communities along the way. And the last thing you want is to have kind of an extractive industry that serves rich big cities and not people along the way. And that's a wonderful feature of storage, where you can have storage in a mini grid, for example, an old truck battery or a recycled Tesla Powerwall as the power storage hub for a small community. That's what we're installing in Nicaragua and in Kenya, and on the Hopi and Zuni Native American reservations in the United States. And larger scale storage systems like the one I took down in the slides, which I'll kind of bravely try to put back up, this utility scale flow battery in California, that's a facility installed by the Southern California Edison, and it will be a utility scale storage system that we will use to soak up extra solar, extra power from hydro when the demand is low, and to put that back into the system, where ideally, not only does the utility profit, to make utilities profitable again, but also it's an opportunity to invest so that a new building that's going up could put a storage system in the basement, or a new housing complex could decide they want to put storage in a big utility shed. And so making storage a market commodity. This is this new facility. It's a flow battery. It's a battery that never degrades. It's got significant storage here, and it's being powered by solar, and it was installed and paid for by Southern California Edison.
It never degrades, you said.
Yeah, you can run a million or more cycles on a flow battery. It's a weak sulfuric acid solution that you slosh back and forth between the tanks. You want a bigger one, you add more tanks. It is a very modular system, and it's a wonderful way to integrate in storage that doesn't have the problem of degradation that your cell phones and your laptops do have.
Okay, did any other questions pop up? We have some more here, but I think we got to move on to the next thing.
Well, I think that the thing to say is that if anyone wants to send me questions, or if you guys can compile them, that would be a great way. And I'm happy to send back some answers. Like I see the one here from Dee about the Berkeley Cool Climate Calculator And yes, you put in the number of miles you fly, and people like me who fly a lot, we need to offset a lot because we are carbon pigs. But I'm happy to collect a few and answer a few questions back. And again, if anyone follows that Twitter, at Dan_Kamen, I'll post some of the answers there and I'll send them back to you guys as well.
All right. Well, thanks for an hour of your time. It looks like you're in the car, so you're probably transporting daughters from one place to another.
I'm just sitting at a horse ranch.
we are talking about tariff bindings, and horses was our example. So there it is, a photo.
Actually, I'll do it this way. So that's my horse-obsessed daughter out there riding. So again, I come to DC a lot because of the Science Envoy role. I'm happy to chat with people who want to. And again, following those websites is a great way for us to stay connected. So I look forward to more conversations.
All right. Beautiful, Dan. And thanks for your work. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.